Good morning. This is Howell Jackson, and I'd like to welcome you to Lecture 13 of our series on the regulation of financial institutions. In today's lecture, we will continue our consideration of the regulation of insurance companies in the United States, and in particular, we will take a look at solvency regulation of insurance companies. Now, this is a topic, solvency regulation, that we've already looked at in the context of depository institutions in this lecture series. If you will recall from our lectures last spring, we spend a fair amount of time looking at capital regulation of depository institutions. That is, the rules governing the amount of capital depository institutions in the United States are required to have in order to remain in business. We also looked at the disposition of failed banks, and in particular in connection with our discussion of the relevant sections of Chapter 5 of the casebook, we discussed the various strategies that U.S. regulatory officials use to dispose of insolvent banks. Now, in the context of insurance companies, we are not going to revisit the question of capital regulation. As I mentioned a few lectures ago, there are elaborate capital rules for insurance companies in the United States, and to a certain degree, they are modeled on aspects of the risk-based capital rules that have been developed for depository institutions. And we're not going to look at those rules again in this section of the lecture series. We are, however, going to take a look at the solvency regulations with respect to failed insurance companies in this section, because the rules are a little bit different in this area, and a number of issues that are raised by these differences, I think, are interesting to consider. And also, there are a number of implications for international financial services regulation that I want to pose at the end of the session. So, we're going to be looking at something that is somewhat familiar, but in a slightly new context. Those of you who are following along in the casebook, I have posted on the assignment sheet the relevant pages for solvency regulation from Chapter 7, and I hope that most of you will have had a chance to look at these materials. They're not lengthy, but there's a certain degree of complexity to the transactions we're going to be discussing in today's lecture, and I think it might be helpful if you have at least skimmed the relevant sections of the casebook before hearing this lecture. In following lectures, we will discuss rate regulation and demutualization, but today our topic is simply solvency regulation. Now, as you'll see if you look through the casebook, we begin this section with a discussion of something called the Executive Life Insurance Corporation's failure in the early 1990s. This company, Executive Life, is occasionally referred to as ELIC, E-L-I-C. That was an abbreviation that it was known by. And it's an important illustration of insurance company insolvency. And in many respects, I think the most interesting insurance company failure in the United States over the past 10 or 20 years. Now, Executive Life was a not quite revolutionary, but certainly a very innovative insurance company, pioneering a product known as the Guaranteed Investment Contract, or GIC. The GIC is a variant on a traditional insurance company annuity. An annuity is an insurance contract that insurance policyholders purchase, and in return for the payment of a single premium or a series of premiums, they receive in return a fixed amount, or sometimes a variable amount, of income over a period. Traditionally, the payout period was the remaining years of a person's life. And so the annuity was related to life insurance, but rather than having a product that paid out upon death, this is a product that paid out over the remainder of one's life. It's quite a useful product for individuals who are uncertain how long they're going to live, who are uncertain how many financial assets they need to accumulate during their working life in order to carry them through their retirement years. And it is a traditional product sold by life insurance companies. Often implicit in traditional annuities was a rate of return for money invested. And what Executive Life and a number of other life insurance companies did in the 1980s was focus on this aspect of the annuity and make an annuity contract that was primarily designed to give a yield, a fixed yield, to policyholders during a specified period, 5 years, 10 years, 1 year, some fixed period of time. And the products often also had the option of converting at the end of the term into a traditional annuity, but they also allowed for the policyholder to withdraw their money at the end of the term and just receive the fixed payment on the instrument and no, what's sometimes referred to as mortality feature. And the Executive Life Insurance Company was particularly successful in offering these products. And one of the reasons that it was successful is that it invested a large share of its assets in what are sometimes referred to as high-yield bonds, also known sometimes as junk bonds. But these were new debt instruments that were developed in the 1980s, particularly with the Drexel investment banking firm and its leader, Mike Milken, during the 1980s. And Executive Life was a major purchaser of these high-yield, somewhat risky contracts for investment, these junk bonds. And as you can see on the balance sheet that I have on the screen here, roughly 60% of Executive Life's assets were invested in junk bond just before the company became insolvent. So with the higher returns that the company was receiving on these junk bonds, it was able to offer a relatively high level of payment on its guaranteed investment contracts and other annuities. And for that reason, it was a very successful entrant into this sector of the financial services industry through the 1980s. Now, the materials in the casebook begin with a discussion of Executive Life from the perspective of the California Insurance Commissioner. And let's take a look now at what the balance sheet of this institution looked like as those letters from the California Commissioner were being sent out to ELIX policyholders in early 1991. What you see if you look on page 479 and the following pages of the casebook is that there has been a substantial devaluation in the amount of assets held by Executive Life. The junk bonds in particular have declined in value from $6 billion to roughly $3 billion. In other words, they've declined in value by roughly 50%. And as a result, principally of this decline in value, the institution's assets are substantially less than its obligations to policyholders. Its equity is depleted, and it is clearly insolvent in a balance sheet sense. Those of you who are not familiar with the junk bond market, this decline in value was widespread. It wasn't just the junk bonds held by Executive Life. It was a problem in the late 1980s and early 1990s that occurred throughout the financial services industry in the United States. And there were a number of reasons for this decline. One reason for the decline was that there was simultaneously an investigation of the Drexel investment company that I mentioned before. And in fact, its head, Mike Milliken, was the subject of a federal prosecution and actually eventually did have to go to prison for certain violations of the federal securities laws. The Drexel Company was itself shut down, and there was at this period a great deal of investor concern with and dissatisfaction over the junk bond market, the result of which the prices declined precipitously at this period. And as a major investor in the junk bond market, Executive Life found itself becoming sort of irreversibly insolvent at this period. And as a result, the insurance regulators intervened and instituted closure procedures and receivership procedures. This is analogous to the procedures we looked at the depository institution side, in particular in the context of the Wampinger Bank failure, where the regulator involved was the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Here it's not the FDIC, but rather the insurance commissioners. And what's interesting about this transaction, among other things, is how it is similar to, but also different from, what we saw on the banking side. So let's proceed along and talk a little bit about what the insurance commissioner, Mr. Garamondi, was communicating to the policyholders. In essence, he told them that the company was in fact insolvent and the assets were actually inadequate to honor all of the contractual liabilities of the Executive Life Corporation. And if you read through the letters, you can get a rough sense of the relationship between the assets and the liabilities. And let me just tease some of the numbers out for you. One of the things that the letters are concerned with is the payout rates, how much money is available for the annuity and other policyholders if the assets are distributed on a pro rata basis. And here there's a certain amount of complexity in the letters, which is explained a little bit in the notes following the letters, but let me just describe them to you. At first blush, the commissioner seems to be saying that the asset payout rate will be something like 89%, that there are roughly enough assets to pay 89 cents on the dollar for all individuals with personal annuities with ELIC. And that's roughly the ratio that $6.2 billion of assets will pay out on $7 billion of personal annuity liabilities. However, the opinion, the letters, do note that there is a difference of opinion about whether or not all $6.2 billion should go to the personal annuity holders. There is a claim from other creditors of the insurance company, in particular the so-called muni GICs or municipal guaranteed investment contracts, that they should share in the assets to the same extent as the personal annuities. And as you'll know, as you read through the casebook, if you've read through the casebook, this argument by the muni GIC holders ultimately was adopted by a court in California, and the initial assessment of the insurance commissioners turns out to have been incorrect, that in fact, rather than being able to get an 89% payout for the personal annuity holders, in fact, the commissioner was only able to secure something like a 70% payout because the muni GIC holders with $1.8 billion worth of claims also got to share in the assets of the institution. So the commissioner's initial perspective was the muni GIC holders should get a second priority, should come after the personal annuity holders, and in that case they would get essentially nothing because all of the assets would be used for the personal annuity holders. But the courts disagreed under an interpretation of California insurance law they concluded that the muni gig holders were, in fact, to be treated as any other kind of policyholder and therefore got a 70% share of the assets. So this is, I think, a classic problem of receivership that you would see in many contexts, corporate context as well as financial institution context. But I would just recall at this point that this is a kind of problem that we considered in the depository institution in that section of the lecture series. There was a question of how much money should be distributed to uninsured depositors in the Wampinger Bank failure, which was the problem we looked at last spring. This is a classic dispute. The receiver favors honoring a smaller class of claims because it preserves the state's assets, but sometimes the claimants, oftentimes the claimants, will take a different perspective and argue that they should be treated better. We didn't discuss in this lecture series the definition of deposit on the banking side, but in the casebook there are some materials, particularly the Philadelphia Gear case, that explore this issue, and it's a constant and similar battle on the depository institution side about what kind of liabilities of banks constitute deposits and therefore get the preferred treatment afforded depositors under federal banking law. Here, the question is what constitutes a policyholder entitled to preference under insurance law in California, and the court, as it turns out in this particular case, agrees with the muni gig holders that they do get the same priority. That dilutes the assets available for the regular personal annuities. Now, one of the interesting things to explore in this bank failure are other analogies to banking. I just mentioned the problem of trying to figure out who gets a claim on the institution, who is in the preferred category, but there are also analogies on the way the institution finds itself in insolvency. You'll recall from the bank materials that we looked at that typically on the banking side, the way this occurs is that examiners come in and inspect the books, assess the quality of loan portfolios, and as a result of an examination process, conclude that some of the loans are non-performing and therefore need to be written down. That was how the problems were identified in the Cucciata case that we looked at in the depository institution section. It was also the way the problems arose in the Wampinger problem that we worked on in the depository institution section. Here, something similar is going on. The problem is detected through supervisory techniques. However, because the junk bonds are publicly traded securities, the problem is detected not so much by examination, but simply by monitoring the value of executive life assets through a monitoring of the bond markets more generally. So in certain respects, the regulatory task for the insurance regulators here is simpler because they're looking at a marketable asset, that's the dominant asset of the institution, and it makes it easier to detect movements in prices because the market is constantly revising its assessment of the junk bonds. So in certain respects, junk bonds are easier to monitor than illiquid assets like loans. That's a regulatory advantage. There is, of course, always the question about whether the market's evaluations are accurate, and that's something that we'll return to in a little while. But in the first instance, it's easier to supervise these kinds of assets that insurance companies tend to focus on than other kinds of assets we've seen already in this lecture series. Now, one final query that I'd like you to think about in this problem is the question about the relationship between the payout rates and what the policyholders are actually going to get in this particular transaction. Now, I mentioned, and it's shown on the slide above, that The assets are either enough to cover 70% or maybe 89% of the preferred liabilities in this case. Nevertheless, the commissioner in his letters to the policyholders keeps referring to a 100% payout ratio, keeps referring to the fact that 95% of the policyholders are going to have their policies honored according to their terms. And the question you should just think about for a second is, what's the relationship between these two facts? There aren't enough assets, yet a good number of the policyholders, in fact, the vast majority of policyholders, are going to have their contracts honored as initially written. Well, the answer to this question comes from the fact that there is an insurance scheme, a public insurance scheme, comparable to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in the context of the insurance industries in the United States. And most policyholders, those with policies of under $100,000 face value, are going to have coverage under these indemnification provisions of the life insurance guarantee organizations. So this is analogous to the $100,000 insured deposit protection that depositors in American banks and thrifts enjoy. However, it's also different in some very interesting respects. How is it different? Well, one way in which it's different is the insurance schemes are operated on a state-by-state basis and not at the federal level. And so as the Garamendi letters indicate, in order for this protection to be afforded, there has to be an agreement among up to 50 different state regulatory officials who operate these guarantee funds in the individual states of our country. So it's a more cumbersome operation than what we see in the depository institution side. It's also different in that the level of coverage varies from state to state to a certain degree. California and many states honor contracts up to $100,000, but other states have slightly different protections. Some go up to $200,000 or even $300,000 of protection. So there is some variation between the states. But at this point, all, or for practical purposes, all states in the country have some form of protection similar to what we see in California. So we have a insurance scheme like the banking sector. It's limited like the banking sector. Those who are covered by the insurance scheme have complete protection. Those who are not covered by the insurance scheme will have their contracts honored up to the payout ratios, basically. So 70% of value or 89% of value, whatever the number is, that's what they will be entitled to receive under their policies. So they are limited in their protection, and I won't dwell on it here, the reasons why we have these insurance schemes, but essentially they are paternalistic mechanisms to ensure that individuals have their insurance in place when they need it, and that the solvency of the companies does not prevent them from having their contracts honored according to their terms. The advantages, I think, are pretty clear cut. There are also, of course, some disadvantages in terms of moral hazard problems, analogous to issues that we've already considered in the context of depository institutions. So I think rather than focus on this aspect of the executive life transaction here, I'd like to move on and discuss a little bit the several cases that arose out of this failure in the United States. The first case, it's sort of interesting, is about the Muni GICs. The Muni GICs are those contracts, which were elevated to first priority along with the personal annuities that I just discussed. But they continued to be the subject of a fair amount of litigation, including the Commercial National case, which begins on page 483 of the casebook. And what this case really looks into is the question of what valuation and what distribution rights the muni GICs should get. And to understand this phenomenon, you need to know a little bit about how the muni GICs were structured, because it is a little bit of a complicated transaction. On the balance sheet of Executive Life Insurance Corporation, there was a contract, an annuity contract, with trustee holders agreeing to pay out a fixed rate of interest. And what these contracts were designed to do was to fund resources raised by municipalities, that is cities, hence the name municipal, for various construction contracts. So the overall contract looked a little bit more like this. We had municipalities that hired trustees, and the trustees would hold the proceeds of bonds issued to the investing public. The proceeds would come into the trustee, be reinvested with ELIC for some period of time, and then withdrawn by the trustee as needed for construction projects, such as airports or highways, and they would be built, and the proceeds from these airports or highways in terms of fees or other revenues would eventually be used to repay the initial bondholders. So what this was an interim kind of investment for municipal bond proceeds while the funds were awaiting use in their particular project. And really, it was a bank account for the investment proceeds to be used pending their deployment for the actual construction for which they were intended. And that was the reason why the California commissioner thought they really were not insurance products, but they were something else more akin to bank deposits. And in fact, they were directly competitive with bank deposits. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the Commercial National case is the disputes that this arrangement arose in terms of ELIC's disposition as an insolvent institution. I think this part of the opinion is fairly technical, and I think it will be of more interest to those members of the lecture series who care about bankruptcy issues. And so I will just touch upon the issues here. But there's a discussion in the case of the so-called two-tier system. And what was going on here is the municipal bonds were trading in the public markets in the United States. And a lot of municipal bondholders, when ELIC got into trouble and the proceeds that were being held by ELIC looked like they might never be returned to the indenture trustees, well, these investors sold their bonds into the capital markets and got out, probably at a small fraction of their initial investment. So they may have invested $1.8 billion in bonds, but a lot of those bonds were sold at a deep discount at much less than 100 cents on the dollar. And what the ELIC trustee wanted to do is to simply repay the bondholders based on what they actually invested in the bonds in the secondary market. So that would dramatically reduce the obligations of ELIC for the bond investors. Now, what the equity of what the trustee was trying to do is to prevent a windfall for the bond investors who bought at, say, 30 cents on the dollar. If they enjoyed a payout rate of 70 cents on the dollar, which is the payout rate that the GICs were supposed to get, they would actually enjoy a profit on their investment of 40 cents on the dollar. And to the ELOC trustees, that just seemed to be unfair and wrong to use insurance company proceeds to create a profit for the investors. And it's an interesting argument and one that some of the members of this class may find powerful, but the court ultimately rejected it on rather formal grounds, which is that the contract for ELOC was with the indenture trustee, not with the bondholders. The indenture trustee had paid in the full $1.8 billion worth of municipal GIC value, and therefore the indenture trustee was entitled to get a pro rata share of that $1.8 million back. So the muni bond investors were not in privity with the executive life insurance company, and therefore when the particular investors had bought muni bonds was not considered to be relevant to the liquidation rights of the indenture trustee. So that's a formal explanation. A more policy-oriented explanation comes from the fact that it might be highly undesirable to diminish the rights of bondholders depending on when they purchased the securities. If you go back in time and ask yourself what such a ruling would do to the initial bondholders when they tried to dispose of their bonds, I think you can readily see that they would be greatly disadvantaged by such a ruling, and that would raise the cost of bonds and would also have other problematic, potentially problematic effects in future transactions. So even though individual bondholders may profit in this situation, there are some advantages for allowing them to succeed to the same rights as the initial investors. And I think that makes a certain amount of sense and explains the court's decision from a policy perspective, although, as I said, it interpreted the law fairly formally here. The other interesting question is over the valuation of the assets and trying to figure out which date should be used, either the initial date or some subsequent date. Again, I'll leave this aspect of the opinion for those of you who are interested in the area, but I think it is also worth mentioning why this dispute arose. I told you that ELOC failed because of a decline in the junk bond market that brought down the value of its assets. And it turns out that the junk bond market recovered shortly after the company became insolvent and was shut down. And the value of assets of the institution went up in the following year. And an interesting question was, who should benefit from this rise in asset values? Did that belong to the bondholders? Did that belong to the trustees, indenture trustees, or did it belong to the insurance commissioners? And it was an interesting debate in this particular case because the values went up so much that while it would not have returned ELOC to a solvency, I don't believe, it would have made a very big difference in the payout rates, and that's an issue of design that needs to be attended to in the disposition of failed financial institutions as well as in other contexts. But interesting question. Those of you who are interested, I'd invite you to take a look at that. I think you might find particularly interesting the valuation question for the muni bond investors. But at this stage, I'd like to move on to another case arising under the ELOC failure, which comes up in a slightly different context. The next case involves litigation between one of the state insurance funds and the Honeywell Corporation. In many respects, the structure is analogous to the Commercial National Bank case we just looked at. there's a plan contract between ELIC and a trustee. This time, rather than being a bond indenture trustee, what we're dealing with is a pension plan trustee for the Honeywell pension plan. Honeywell is a large computer and technology electronics company in the United States with offices and operations in many different jurisdictions. It has a centralized pension plan. The centralized pension plan provides a variety of different kinds of pensions for employees. One significant kind of pension in the United States is the 401k plans, where pension beneficiaries have individual accounts which can be invested in a number of different ways. Typically, the plan sponsors offer participants several selections of investments they can make with their retirement assets. And in the Honeywell Corporation plan, as in many plans in the 1980s, one of the choices was an ELIC guaranteed investment contract that paid a rate of interest, a relatively high rate of interest, over some term of years. And when the ELIC company went insolvent, there was a question of how these contracts would be honored when held by pension plan trustees. And a number of individuals in their retirement accounts in the United States could easily have more than $100,000. Many would have less than $100,000. And of course, the pension plan trustee collectively would have much more than $100,000 as a result of the aggregate investments of individual participants. So it was a very important decision to understand how the individual guarantee funds of the various states would apply to insurance contracts of this sort, because the amounts in question could theoretically often be much in excess of $100,000. So it was important to get coverage for the plans, and it was also important to make sure that the coverage was, to the extent possible, beneath the $100,000 limits applicable in most jurisdictions. And what this case is about is the Arizona Guarantee Fund essentially disagreeing with Honeywell about how the rules should apply in this context, like the disagreement between the ELIC receiver and the municipal GIC bondholders in the case we just took a look at. So that's the background of the litigation, and let's just take a quick look at some of the issues involved. One issue was whether the guarantee fund should be looking to the trustees or whether they should be looking to the participants as the appropriate parties in interest. And that was a very important decision for Arizona, because Arizona only provides protection to Arizona residents for their guarantee funds. And the participants here were all from Arizona, all from an office of Honeywell in Arizona. But the trustee was from another jurisdiction, from one of the eastern states where the main Honeywell office is located. And if the correct person to look at is the trustee for residency, then none of the participants would be covered by the Arizona Fund. They would have to look, to the extent possible, to the fund of the state in which the trustee himself or herself was resident. Now, in this case, as those of you who have read it will know, the court concluded that it was appropriate to look through to the plan participants, to look through to the Arizona residents as the true beneficiaries of these ELIC contracts. And one can see the logic of that. It would seem more fair to look to where the individuals are located than to some state in where the trustee is located. It also means or implies that if they are covered contracts held by the 401k participants, then the relevant limitation of $100,000 per policy will be applied at the participant level as opposed to the trustee level. So that's a very meaningful decision, since the coverage will be much, much more extensive if looked at on, by an individual by individual basis as opposed to by a trustee basis. So one can understand the court's inclination to look through in this context. The one thing I would note, though, and one thing you might want to think about, is in the case of the municipal GICs that we just looked at, the court declined to look through. It took a more formalistic perspective. It concluded that the appropriate party to look at was the trustee of the bond indenture and not the municipal bondholders. So the analysis here is, in certain extent, to a certain extent, in tension with that of the preceding case. The second question that the court considers here is the question of, having looked through to the participants, what is the nature of their contractual arrangement? And in particular, is it the kind of arrangement that is covered by the Arizona Guarantee Fund? Is it a so-called covered annuity or not? And here, the Court of Appeals decision is, I think, quite interesting. It basically says, no, if you look at this contract carefully, it's not really a life insurance contract. There are annuity features in the pension plan that are associated with the contract, but what you're really looking at here is a form of deposit, a fixed return investment issued by ELIC. It doesn't have the mortality risk. It doesn't have the characteristics traditionally associated with annuity contracts. And this is not what the state legislature of Arizona intended to cover when it created the guarantee fund in the enabling statute. And so what the court does here is it backs away from offering any coverage to the participants because they have essentially the wrong sort of contract. This is, I think, an interesting decision. I think it's maybe a fair reading of the statute in a certain sense, although it's quite a harsh result for the participants, which I think is why, as you'll see if you read the notes that follow, the Arizona Supreme Court ultimately reversed this decision and did allow coverage for the plan participants and essentially allowed them the protections that were afforded to traditional annuity holders and, as a result of that decision, also holders of GICs. This aspect of the opinion, I think, should be and can be nicely contrasted with the discussion of the municipal GICs that I mentioned earlier. As we discussed, there was a debate when the ELIC company failed about whether or not the municipal GICs should or should not be considered policyholders. That's exactly the same kind of argument that's going on in this case, but the issue is whether the 401k participants should be considered covered policyholders or not. One difference between the contexts, just to keep it straight in your minds, is the municipal GIC case was about essentially the corporate law of insurance companies, the priority in a liquidation proceeding. This case is not about that issue. It's about the extent of insurance coverage by the Arizona Guarantee Fund. It has much the same result. It determines how much the 401k participants will get, but it arises out of the terms of the guarantee fund arrangement, not about the organic nature of ELIC and the corporate statute under which it is organized. There are a lot of things that I think are interesting about the Arizona Guarantee Fund case. One of them is it shows some of the difficulties of having a system with multiple insurance guarantee funds in different states. The aspect of the decision about what is the resident of the trustee shows you how a different conclusion on that issue could get quite different results in terms of coverage. And as the decision itself indicates, similar disputes were arising in numerous jurisdictions around the United States, and there were different interpretations coming up. So policyholders of ELIC-GICs in certain jurisdictions got essentially quite different coverage than similarly situated policyholders in other jurisdictions in the United States. And one can easily imagine the potential for confusion in this context and the perceived inequity of someone getting better coverage just because they happen to live in one state than their neighbors across the state line with a slightly different insurance guarantee fund statute, or perhaps even the same statute but slightly different judicial interpretations of how the statute applies. So it illustrates some of the problems that can arise in this context and presents one of the challenges of having a federal system of financial institutions insurance that differs in certain critical respects from state to state. The other aspect of the case the commercial national case that I like, and one of the reasons we included these in the casebook, is that it actually shows a realistic picture of the financial services industry in the United States, in the sense that a number of different sectors are often involved in single transactions. The ELIC life insurance companies from the insurance industry, it's offering a product both to the Honeywell Corporation pension plan and also to the municipal GIC bondholders that's quite similar to a bank deposit. So what you're seeing here is an insurance company making adjustments to traditional insurance products in order to be competitive in a realm that was traditionally handled by the banking sector of our financial services industry. You also see here a number of different financial institutions getting involved in purchasing the ELIC-GICs. In this case, in the Honeywell case, you see the pension plan trustee lining up the GICs for pension plan participants. In the Commerce National case, you see a bank trustee, a bank serving as trustee, purchasing this essentially bank substitute for the bond holders. So as these series of cases suggest, there's a lot of interaction among sectors of the financial services industry in the United States, and sometimes it's easy to lose sight of that as we proceed through looking at the sectors case by individual sector by individual sector. But in reality, our financial markets operate much more in this interrelated way, and we'll see a good deal more of that as we work our way through the rest of the materials, particularly the final section of the casebook. Now, I'd like to turn to some policy issues that are raised by the insurance solvency materials that we've been discussing in this section of the course. And I think in terms of the readings with which these comments are associated, mostly the NAIC accreditation program materials will be useful, as well as the notes following the Honeywell case on pages 497 and 498. A natural topic, I think, to just mention at this point is a comparison of the liquidation rules for insurance companies and banks, and to focus a little bit about some of their differences and just raise for you the question of which kind of rules are more sensible as a matter of regulatory design. The chief differences between them, I think I've highlighted already. The federal deposit insurance system for the banking sector is a national system, whereas the insurance disposition system is a state system. That gives rise to a number of problems that we've looked at in the context of the Honeywell situation and the municipal GIC situation that are potentially problematic. And I think at a minimum, the kind of difficulties that require coordination among state systems, if you are going to have a well-functioning disposition structure. Of course, the problems of coordination are acute only if you have a large number of institutions operating across state lines. In the United States, however, that is the case. We have a number of national insurance companies operating in many markets, and coordination is necessary for those institutions when they get into financial difficulties. For institutions that are just local in nature, problems of coordination are less acute, but they still exist if there is any spillover between jurisdictions. The United States federal system, for those of you who are familiar with it, is a little bit unusual because we have certain markets that are large and self-contained. States like California and Texas are large in geographic size and have many economic markets that are completely contained by the states. But on the eastern coast of the United States, where the states tend to be smaller and the economic markets tend to spread across jurisdictional lines, there are large numbers of cases when even local companies operate on a multi-state basis. Another difference, and one that I think it's interesting to focus on for just a second, is differences in funding mechanisms between bank and insurance liquidation rules. The casebooks really mentions these only in passing, but I think they're quite important as a matter of regulatory design. On the FDIC side, we use what's known as a pre-funding mechanism for the most part. We try to collect the funds necessary to do bank dispositions ahead of time based on deposit insurance premiums, and we try to maintain a reserve of a certain percentage of deposits in the system. Our current target is 1.25% of deposits, and actually that's a level that we are currently at in the United States. But it's a pre-funding system. The reserves are there to use when they are needed. The state insurance system uses what's known as a post-funding system. They raise the money after the fact by assessments. And their assessment system is sort of interesting. It basically is done by insurance lines, so the entire insurance industry doesn't raise money to pay for insurance company losses. Rather, the money is raised by the life insurance industry for life insurance companies, by the property and casualty insurance sector for problems in that sector, and so on. So it's targeted in a more narrow way, and it's raised on a state-by-state basis. So in the ELIC failure, the cost for the fund to bail out California residents would be borne by California life insurance companies, the cost in New York by New York life insurance companies, cost in Arizona by Arizona life insurance companies. So it's a much more segmented raising of funds, and it's also one that has certain limitations in terms of capacity. Most of the state insurance statutes say only a certain amount of money can be raised per year in this manner, and so as the readings indicate, if there were a large number of insurance company failures in the United States in a particular period, the reserves that could be collected, at least in a single year, would not be adequate to cover all of the costs. So you would have a capacity problem in the event of a large failure or a series of potentially medium-sized failures. So, different system, post-funding versus pre-funding, assessment by line and state as opposed to sort of national general assessments being the dominant form of funding on the bank side. I think I would like to leave to the class to consider which is a better approach, and which is a better approach were China to create funds of this sort, I think is an interesting question that you might want to consider. And if you want to post answers to that or consider that, how you would evaluate that on the Threaded discussion site, which is now operational, I think that would be interesting. And I will be happy to take a look at what you do. And Chen Wei Hung, our teaching assistant for this term, I hope will also participate in this part of the discussion group as well. But just ask yourself, which approach should China implement if it were to get into the guarantee fund business for its financial institutions? The final area of regulatory design that I think is sort of interesting for you to take a look at is in connection with the NAIC accreditation project, which is discussed on pages 498 to 506 of the casebook. There's a little bit of background on this project. It was initiated, I think it's fair to say, into response to concerns that the state insurance regulatory system in the United States was not performing adequately, particularly with respect to problems such as the ones that occurred at executive life. And there's a little background on the regulatory reaction to executive life, particularly before the failure. Some suggestion that individual states were aware of the problems in executive life and were slow to react and to advise each other of the problems. And the implication of some of the congressional oversight in this area was that a federal initiative, a federal regulatory structure, maybe more analogous to our banking structure, might be appropriate in this area, at least for the large firms operating on a national basis. And in response to this, what the NAIC did, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, is begin an accreditation program of really strengthening its standards for state oversight and trying to basically assure that the individual states were doing an adequate job in implementing those standards. So I will leave it to you to look through and see what the content of the program was. It consists at root at developing a number of additional model statutes and then trying to get the individual states to adopt both the model statutes and to create enforcement task forces and personnel that were capable of implementing the standards in each jurisdiction of the United States. One of the interesting questions of efforts of this sort are how does one make sure that they are enforced in the individual jurisdictions? And the NAIC itself has no binding authority on the states. It's an organization consisting of state insurance commissioners, but it can't force the insurance commissioners to do anything. And in fact, as you'll see when if you go through these materials, it's not really the insurance commissioners that adopt the enabling statutes. That must be done by the state legislatures. And so the NAIC really is making simply a suggestion to the local commissioners that they try to persuade their local legislatures to adopt the rules as recommended. So since it cannot enforce the mechanisms of accreditation, it had to have another device, and I think one of the interesting things about this initiative is the device that it selected. Essentially, as part of the accreditation process, each state was supposed to amend its laws to essentially discriminate against other jurisdictions that had not become accredited under the NAIC standards. And the idea would be that if an insurance company was from an unaccredited state, it would have to go through a supplementary examination process before it would be permitted to do business in other jurisdictions. Traditionally in the United States, there's a fair amount of deference to the supervisory apparatus of other states, and essentially most states accept the examination and supervisory oversight of other jurisdictions. And what the NAIC tried to do was to change that system to grant deference only to accredited states. Now, one of the things that the materials illustrate is, while theoretically this is an interesting and potentially effective way of policing states to come into compliance with the NAIC standards, and the logic is that companies from jurisdictions that are unaccredited will find themselves at a competitive disadvantage as they try to expand around the country, and will therefore put pressure on their own state legislatures to adopt and implement the NAIC standards as required. That's the logic. But the problem is it's been difficult to work out. One of the principal difficulties is that one of the major jurisdictions, New York, got into trouble with the accreditation process because certain things New York was doing didn't live up to the standards that the NAIC had set, and they tried to penalize New York in the prescribed way. But the problem was, first of all, New York was itself too attractive a market to isolate in this way, and also many of the states wanted to have New York companies providing services to their customers, so it was just there was inadequate political will to penalize a state such as New York in the way suggested. And so some accommodation had to be worked out. And as you can see if you read through the materials, what happened is there was this concept of zone examination that if the an insurance company was in a regional zone, a series of neighboring states, where at least one state was accredited, then that company's zone examinations would count for the NAIC accreditation program, and the company would be able to do business on favorable terms throughout the country. So that was kind of a convenient interpretation that the NAIC acquiesced to in order to prevent an outright conflict with the New York authorities. And it was essentially a backing down of the NAIC. Sort of unfortunate that they had this problem with New York. Had the first state to get in trouble been a smaller state, things might have worked out a little bit differently. But New York was too powerful within the insurance industry. So rather than being an ironclad enforcement mechanism, the NAIC accreditation program has turned out to be more of an advisory set of standards, which I think it's fair to say has improved overall the oversight at the state level, but has not guaranteed complete compliance from all jurisdictions. What I think you should take away from the NAIC accreditation program is the creativity of the NAIC in developing standards and trying to improve the quality of state insurance regulation. It has succeeded, I suppose, in its task with the accreditation program to the extent that there is not much impetus at the federal level for insurance company oversight now. So compared to the early 1990s, when problems like the executive life problem had raised the question of whether we should impose regulation at the federal level, that doesn't seem to be a live issue right now in the United States. So I think that's one interesting thing to take away. But I think really even more interesting aspect of this program is its implications for a broader context. And in particular, what I mean is the international context. Because the United States has broken up insurance regulation among the states rather than at the federal level, we have had to develop a lot of expertise in cross-border cooperation. Now, precisely the same problems are arising nowadays in the international financial context. And the analogy, I think, to the NAIC accreditation program would be the Basel Committee's work on both bank capital requirements that we've already discussed, and more generally, core principles of regulation for not only depository institutions, but insurance companies and securities firms around the world. What the Basel Committee has tried to do is something akin to the accreditation program, set basic minimum standards that all regulatory officials might aspire to meet. And if you want to see what those basic standards look like, I'd invite you to take a look at the Bank of International Settlements homepage, which I have a link in the international finance section of my internet resources. They are developing basically standards, and it's a worthwhile exercise. I think it's going to be an influential exercise over time. But the same problems that plague the NAIC accreditation program potentially plague the Basel standards in the area of enforcement. How do you get different countries to live up to these standards? What penalties do you impose? Should you have a rule that depository institutions or other financial firms from a country that is not up to the Basel standards should be penalized in their cross-border international transactions? Is that appropriate? Interesting questions about whether that's permitted under the WTO evolving rules for financial services, which is kind of an aside. But it's also an interesting question as a matter of policy, of sovereignty of countries. Should they be obliged and coerced to live up to these standards or not? And I think this is an interesting question that some of you may want to address on the thread of discussion. What we can learn from the NAIC program in the international context, what we might want to emulate, how similar are the issues when you move away from the coordination of regulation in a federal system to coordination of regulation in a international system. Interesting questions. We'll discuss them more as we go along in the lecture series, but I wanted just to flag them at this point. So this concludes our lecture 13 on the regulation of financial institutions. I hope you enjoyed the lecture. Next week we'll take a look at the rate regulation of insurance companies, and the assignments for that lecture will be posted on the syllabus and assignment sheet. I hope you've enjoyed the lecture, and I look forward to seeing you next week.